Okay, it's August 4th, 2010, and we're at the offices of the OCC in Washington, D.C. to interview Mr. David K. Wilson, who is currently Deputy Comptroller of Credit and Market Risk, according to his business card he just gave me.
That's correct.
Mr. Wilson, my name is Chris Seifer, and this is Claire Moraine and Al Crago. We're all with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. That was established by a statute passed last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act of 2009 that directs us to figure out the various causes of the financial crisis. And in that regard, it tells us to look at several things, including institutions that failed or would have failed but for the receipt of exceptional government assistance. It tells us to look at the role of non-traditional mortgages, subprime mortgage lending, tells us to look at the role of regulation, tells us to look at the issue of quote-unquote too big to fail. So we are in the process of looking at, amongst other things, the issue of too big to fail and the institution of Wachovia, since at least initially the systemic risk exception to FDICA was invoked to approve Citi's assisted bid, that of course ultimately was not necessary because Wells came in with an unassisted bid. So I'm primarily going to be asking you about that. But before I ask you about that, let me first let Linda Bridgman say a couple of things for the record about a couple of documents from yesterday's interview of Kim Scherer.
Regarding Countrywide, thank you. I wanted to give you two documents that Kim Scherer discussed. And the first one is a March 30th, 2006, supervisory letter 2006-03, which I've marked as document number 5 because that's the next in our series. And that was a supervisory letter issued to Countrywide regarding the independent appraisal ordering process that we talked about yesterday, which was a major issue with Countrywide, and I think Kim thought it was one of the issues that caused them to flip their charter. So that supervisory letter was issued in March 2006, and it was still, the MRAs in that document were still pending when the bank flipped its charter in March 2007 and is referred to as a pending issue in the document we marked as number 1. So that was a significant issue, and it was transferred, or the OTS was notified about that issue in March 2007. The other document that I've given you is November 14th, 2006, supervisory letter 2006-10, and that was a supervisory letter issued to Countrywide with MRAs in it, one of which regarded automated valuation model validation, and she talked about that yesterday too. And that document is marked as number 6, and that was also pending MRA in March 2007 when the bank flipped charters and was included in the document we marked as number 1, which was given to the OTS in notification of that problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so Mr. Wilson, before we get to the business at hand on Wachovia, could you please summarize your educational and work background, starting with college, please?
Okay. Graduated from a bachelor's degree from University of Missouri at Columbia, summa cum laude, and I immediately went to the OCC. So I started right out of college at the OCC. Typical supervision examiner in the Midwest, mainly St. Louis, Kansas City. Did that for about 16 years. And then after, it would be early 1992, I accepted a job through a headhunter to go to the old First Interstate Bank on the West Coast. I started out as a regional manager for credit review in Portland, Oregon. And then 3 years later was promoted to an EVP and manager of credit review for the corporation. Did that until, ironically, Wells bought us, but under very different circumstances. They paid a lot of money for us back then for First Interstate. But as a result of that, I was one of the people that wasn't needed anymore. So I ended up back at the OCC in Charlotte. I started back in late 1997, and at that time just sort of a core credit staff member. Not long after that, I became a credit team leader at the old First Union, which of course then bought Wachovia, and assumed the name of Wachovia. In 2004, I was named examiner in charge, and I had that position until that weekend in September.
Of 2008,
excuse me.
So when did you graduate Missouri?
1976.
And that's when you started at the OCC?
Yeah, May of 76.
Okay, that's right. That takes us to 92. And then just so the record's clear, when you say you're the senior credit person at First Union, you mean for the OCC?
For the OCC, right. Yes. I'm sorry. Yeah, I was back at the OCC.
Okay. So, okay. And do you remember the year that you started working at First Union as a senior credit person for the OCC?
Well, I started on sort of the core staff, you know, the OCC core staff at First Union when I came back, and that was like October 97.
Okay.
And I did that for a while, and about a year and a half later, they named me the credit team leader on the core staff. And within credit, you know, we have a number of people, and so they have a team leader, and then the team leader reports to the examiner in charge. So
when you say the core staff, does that mean the core credit staff for the OCC or the core credit staff for credit on First Union?
No, for the OCC.
Okay.
As you probably know, on our largest banks, we have on-site staffs, and I was on that staff.
Okay. And then, again, in 2004, you become the examiner in charge for Wachovia.
Correct.
Okay. And then, so do you conduct regular annual examinations?
What we do is we do a number, I would say, between 50 and 60 sort of deep dive reviews of specific areas, like, for example, commercial real estate or, you know, similar to probably what Kim told you. And then on an annual basis, we do an annual report of examination that sort of summarizes at a very high level all our findings from these deep dive. In addition to that, we do what's called ongoing supervision, and that's just staying connected to the bank. All our core staffs have models where we receive all the major MIS, you know, board information, things like that, and then we just conduct ad hoc meetings, inquiries. We have a series of regular meetings where we meet with the various risk managers, audit, line of business managers, things like that, just to try to understand everything that's going on. And that, of course, feeds back into our strategies where we decide what areas we need to look into deeper.
Okay. So, for example, I have with me here, I won't show it to you, but it's the August 4th, 2008 letter transmitting the June 30 examination.
That's our annual report.
Right. And it mentions that in the past year that the OCC had conducted 36 examinations of specific bank activities with conclusions and recommendations communicated to management in individual supervisory letters.
That would be the supervisor.
That's how it works, right?
That's right.
You do these targeted exams, supervisor letters, and at the end of the year, sort of a roll-up.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly.
Now, I've read at least the August 4th, 2008 letter and the attached report, so I know generally what the concerns were at that point and won't go too much into detail on that. But let me ask you a couple of things that go earlier. And that is, of course, one of the things that comes out in this report and comes out later is that the acquisition of Golden West and that payment option arm book was not too good.
Exactly.
When all was said and done.
That's an understatement, yes.
At the time that, and there's comments in here about how there wasn't a lot of challenge when the acquisition was made, et cetera, and perhaps not the greatest due diligence was done. My words summarizing. At the time that Wachovia purchased Golden West in 2006, did the OCC have any concerns or voice any concerns at that time? I haven't gone back that far and looked at the documents.
You know, I would say, yes, we had concerns, but it's also important to note that it wasn't our decision. It wasn't, we weren't really that involved other than just from a corporate standpoint, because, you know, it's the holding company buying the thrift, and they were not asking to merge it into the National Bank. So because of that, we really had no no approval authority. You know, it was really sort of between the Fed and the OTS. Now, as sister institutions in a holding company, obviously we talked to them about it, and you know, the concern at the time, I mean, at that time, Golden West was perceived by everybody as being pristine with no losses, you know. And so at the time, I don't think we had a huge concern other than the fact that we always worried about pay option arms. And prior to Golden West, they had not done any pay option arm business. And, you know, when we Wachovia, the bank, had done not done any. And we talked to them about it, you know, on a regular basis, is, are you going to get into this business? And they said, no, it's not a product that they think should be marketed to the masses and all that. But then the report sort of tells the rest of the story. They went out and bought Golden West.
They being the bank holding company,
Wachovia Corporation, the bank holding company, bought Golden West. And that, of course, was almost totally a pay option arm business. But I think the banks, or not the banks, but the holding company's view and the executive management view was this was very clean. And so, you know, even though it was a pay option arm product, that, you know, it didn't have a lot of risk. And I think that contributed to the lack of due diligence and things like that.
Well, did any of those payment option arm loans ever come in to the bank?
They did.
Okay, so when, how much, why?
They asked us in early 2007 to, they wanted to pull all the branches into Wachovia Bank N.A.
They and being the bank holding company?
Wachovia Executive Management. Wachovia Executive Management came to us and asked, can we bring all the branches, all the Golden West deposits, and approximately half the loans into the National Bank? And at the time we looked at it, we still, at that time, looked like the loans were good. You know, I think the OTS had them rated a one, a Camel one. And so, you know, from our view, we're saying, okay, we're getting in the National Bank all the stable funding sources, being all the deposits. The thrift would be left with Federal Home Loan Bank funding and the loans. And it also gave us a basis, we thought, to actually look at these loans and look at the underwriting of the loans. And
because up to that point,
we couldn't do anything. I mean, you know, we defer to the OTS because it was an OTS, it was a thrift. Wachovia National Bank did not own any of the loans until then. So we allowed that transaction, you know, under the stipulation that the loans that were rolled in would be no worse quality than the loans that they left in the thrift. I mean, we wanted to make sure there wasn't any cherry picking going on. And so, yes, that's.
So at that time, I take it, excuse my lousy pen, the OCC would have reviewed the ballpark 50% of the payment option arm portfolio that was coming into the bank?
Well, we didn't do it in detail because, again, we were reliant on the OTS. We did look at the credit statistics of those loans, and we compared them, and we made sure that what Wachovia Corporation was doing and what the agreement was is no worse quality. So we, you know, looked at, for example, state breakdowns, the typical credit statistics, past dues, things like that. But at the time, they're still, the loans look very clean. I mean, it still looked like the credit statistics were very good still.
And so do you remember when in 07 that occurs?
by the time the transaction actually took place, I may be a month or two off. I want to say it was like August, okay. July, August of 2007.
So probably third quarter 07 that it's on the books.
I think, yes.
And then, so going forward then, at least for the next couple of examinations and targeted exams, you are looking at least.
We're trying to. We had some discussions with the OTS because the underwriting and the servicing was still all in the thrift. So even though the owned loans were on the banks of Wachovia Bank N.A., all the underwriting and servicing was still in the thrift. So we had a number of discussions with the OTS on whether we had a right to look at those loans because they said, well, why is that any different than if Wachovia bought loans that were serviced by WAMU?
Right.
But we did do some, you know, after some discussions, we did one or two joint little reviews, and then we did some reviews just on our own, I guess just one, actually. And these were pretty brief site visits, but they were enough to see that there were some problems in some of these loans that were being coded as retention modifications, which would mean a modification that was to keep the customer, really looked to us to be more like a workout type modification, in that, you know, the customer was having credit problems. There was a cash out refinance that was done in order to bring the customer current on their bills, and you know, we felt that you know, that was sort of a red flag, if you will. But you know, the credit statistics of Golden West and the extent of the problems really start coming out in maybe December 2007, January 2008. I think by February 2008, it was pretty clear that this was going to be a big issue.
So let me ask you, after I write this down, I might be wrong, but I thought when I looked at the overall balances of the payment option ARM book that it remained relatively the same from like 06 to 07 and through to 08 at about $120 billion for, I think, both, not just the bank, but the bank and at the holding company level, at the consolidated level. Were they originating and additional loans after they buy Golden West 1 and after the loans come onto the OCCs, yeah, the bank's books in 07?
And when you say they, who are you referring to?
Wachovia.
Yeah. National Bank.
Right, regardless of where the loans are ending up.
Yeah, I mean, technically the loans are being originated in the thrift.
Right.
There was a lot of activity and they were pushing it a lot. I think, you know, they were having trouble growing the book. There was a lot of refi activity, as I said, you know, a lot of, you know, cash out refis and things like that. They were definitely aggressively pushing it, and they probably aggressively pushed it until around November, December of 2007, when it started to become clear that wasn't a good idea. But yeah, you're right. It didn't really grow much, but it wasn't because they weren't trying, at least initially.
Right, but was it? And I'm just trying to get a sense. Yeah. Was it because a lot of the loan activity was refi activity, or was there also purchase money, payment option arms going on, but other stuff was just paying down?
So yeah, well, I think a little bit of both, but I think most of it was like refi type activity in retrospect. But again, I don't have intimate knowledge of that book because, you know, for the most part it was OTS, but I know the credit statistics on it, but
right. But in third quarter of 07, half the book is in the National Bank, right?
Right, right.
Okay, so I take it from that point on, and look, timing's everything, right?
Yeah.
And shortly thereafter, the credit stats start to deteriorate.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay, other than, I just want to follow up on this because you had mentioned that, you know, you did see some problems in these retention modifications appeared to be not so much retention modifications, but bring the loan current modifications. that combined with the fact that we're not seeing an increase in the outstanding balance overall and that a lot of it's refi, other issues that you guys were finding with the payment option arm book other than this one example you gave?
Well,
and I guess the fact that it's a lot of refi itself may be somewhat of an
issue.
Yeah,
I mean, that was a concern. We had great concern with the pay option ARM product itself, but that's just a general statement. One of the things that we were trying to determine was, are they truly following our non-traditional mortgage guidance that says, are you underwriting to the fully indexed rate? And we'd had discussions with the OTS, and they said that they were. We weren't sure if they were or weren't. Golden West did apparently have a very good collateral evaluation unit, but of course that didn't work out when home prices dropped by 40 or 50%. And the markets that Golden West was the most heavy in, which was like the Inland Empire and Riverside County outside of LA, and you know, some of those places that just got hammered, you know.
So the loans that they're originating after 3Q07, are any of those loans coming onto the bank's books?
By they, you're referring to Golden West as origination?
Let's make sure the record's clear. My understanding is that all originations are still being done in the thrift.
That's correct.
Even after the transfer
that's
of 50%
correct.
Of the loans to the bank.
And as I recall...
Let me stop you for a minute.
Sure.
So my question is, understanding that, are any of those thrift-originated loans coming onto the bank's books?
I'd have to double check, but I don't think any of the new originations were brought back on, or brought over to the books on the National Bank. I think we did that initial transfer, and then they hadn't brought any more.
Okay.
But I would have to double check that. That's how I recall.
And the reason I asked that, and maybe this will help with the recollection, is because you said you were relying on the OTS about whether or not Wachovia was following the non-traditional mortgage guidance and underwriting and qualifying borrowers based on the fully indexed rate as opposed to the teaser rate. I take it, if loans being originated by the thrift were coming to the bank, the loan file would have come over to the bank,
and you
could have seen whether or not that was true.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. That's true.
So me saying that, does that
jog any memory
bells? I don't
think there were any. But I mean, we wouldn't just as the flow came in that we would look at it, but you're right, per our agreement, that if they brought them over, the loans from the thrift to the bank, we would want to make sure that they were no worse quality, you know.
Right. Well, and I take it for whether it's payment option, particularly because it's payment option arm, but as Linda may have told you back in the day, I used to be a bank examiner with the OTS, not with the OCC. But you always do a new loan review just for that purpose, right, to see what's going on with underwriting
standards
what
are they
and
doing?
Making sure they're
exactly.
up to snuff. And
yeah.
Al's FDIC company isn't going to have to break out the checkbook down the road.
Right.
Again, I'm just trying to see if these kinds of statements jog memory bells on, given what you're saying, they weren't transferring the loans over because we would have done a new loan review, we would have seen underwriting standards. The fact that I have no recollection about
I don't think they brought any over, but, you know, even if they did, at the time they brought it over, I don't think we would have been necessarily at that time, you know, doing a new loan review. I mean, we would pull a sample of those loans and review them.
Right.
And that's what we did, in fact, do, you know, on some of the loans that they had brought over on the bulk side. So
At the time of the initial transaction,
yeah.
Okay, let me switch gears a little. As I said in my opening statement, one of the reasons we're looking at Wachovia is because we're looking at the issue of too big to fail. And we know that, at least initially, the FDIC approved the systemic risk exception to fiduciaries to approve Citi's assisted bid. I've seen a memo written by the Richmond Fed, and I've seen a memo written by the FDIC where they go through the reasons that it was necessary in their mind to invoke that systemic risk exception. And it primarily, if not solely, focused on the systemic implications of Wachovia failing. And in particular, it was looking at what's going to happen to creditors that are not insured depositors. And one. Two, what's it going to mean in terms of general confidence in the U.S. banking industry, and three, what's it going to do to the general economy, both national and international, since there were a lot of uninsured depositors that were from outside the country, and I think a fair amount of debt holders that were from outside the United States. And, you know, the conclusion was essentially, we can't afford to let that happen. It's going to be too disruptive to those creditors, to the banking industry in general, and to the economy in general. So I want to focus on what your role was in terms of looking at the systemic implications of a Wachovia failure, and probably, you know, in this late 2008 time frame, after you guys get done with this exam that gets transmitted on August 4th. My first question is, did the OCC prepare any kind of memo or analysis on the systemic implications of Wachovia failing and making any kind of recommendation about whether or not that should occur?
I was not involved in an exercise like that. You need to ask probably Doug Roeder or Mr. Dugan. Obviously, we, you know, spent a lot of time on, you know, contingency plans for liquidity management and things like that. But, you know, doing a paper on whether it was systemically important or not, you know, we didn't do that specifically. I would say that I would agree that it was systemically. I mean, if you think about that September 2008, that you know, if Wachovia just would have been gone to liquidation, and you know, you have all these investments in money market funds, and you have all these counterparties, and you know, the dominoes have been set in effect already, and to have something like that happen to Wachovia would have been a total meltdown. If you say that it wasn't already a total meltdown that was occurring, of course. You know, Wachovia, well, I'll let you ask the questions.
Okay, so I've seen in this exam report and subsequent documents.
By this exam report, you're talking about
the
2008.
August 4th, 2008 letter transmitting the exam report as of June 30th, 2008.
Could we mark this as number one?
Sure, of course. Do you have a copy?
I have a copy.
Even better.
So we'll just mark this.
Do you have the cover letter too, or are you just going with
it? Yeah, it's the August 4th, 2008.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And then I have it. Has yours got Bates numbers on it?
Yeah. It's
871?
Yes.
Okay, good. And I have mine is going all the way through 869, which is the MOU page.
The ROE goes through 903.
Huh? Oh, you know what? Mine's out of order.
I also have the MOU, which is a different Bates stamp.
Right. Yeah, the MOU is a different number. I'm sorry. So that looks to be 853 through 869.
Right.
So let's mark as document number
one.
For the record, the August 4th, 2008 letter to the Wachovia Board of Directors from the OCC, and in particular Mr. Wilson and Mr. Brosnan, attaching the exam report, Bates numbers OCC 15-003-00871 through 903.
I think it starts at 870. Do you have the cover page?
Right. 870-2903. So we'll mark that as document number one. And if we decide to use the MOU, we'll mark that as document two down the road.
Right. And just to be clear, the August 4th, 2008 letter is transmitting the 2008 ROE for Wachovia.
Correct. Thank you. Okay. So I have seen in this and other documents the fact. One, it expresses the OCC's concerns, and two, it talks about the liquidity issues. And even though I think it was still rated a two, there were concerns, and this contingency funding plan had been put in place, and I believe they even got an MRA on liquidity saying, make sure you're planning and dealing with funding issues. But there was actually one thing I wanted to ask you about that on liquidity.
Okay.
Let me find it very quick. Hopefully very quick. Yeah, so on page 12, which is 886 base number,
okay.
You see this is liquidity rating 2 there.
Okay.
And it says there that the market disruption and continued earnings deterioration have reduced funding opportunities and raised funding costs. And while things are adequate, the market is focused on the company's condition and potential events, which could trigger a loss of confidence and further reduce funding opportunities. And this is a sentence I'm interested in. Some large fund providers are already limiting Wachovia exposure. Do you recall who was limiting their exposure to Wachovia?
I don't think it was any of the other major banks, but, you know, some of the institutional counterparties, you know, didn't cut Wachovia off, but we knew that they probably had their own internal limits, and, you know, they were... they're being careful, and I think money market funds is a good example of that, where, you know, they may not have as much of an appetite for Wachovia paper as they would have in the past. So, I mean, there were some strains, but really at the time we wrote this, Wachovia had really no problem funding, but it wasn't like it was just an open checkbook from all the counterparties compared to what it would have been before.
I've seen documents, and tell me if this is consistent with what you recall, that also don't seem to indicate they're having problems funding themselves, but one, it's more expensive, and two, it seems to be getting shorter term.
I think that was probably the case for the whole industry, but yeah.
but that's yes, consistent with yeah. your recollection in
yes,
this time frame?
Yes.
Okay. So let me go back. Understanding you weren't involved in preparing any kind of memo about whether or not the systemic risk exception should be invoked, as we go through and we get to that fun weekend of Saturday, September 27th, mm-hmm. Sunday the 28th, and Monday the 29th, what involvement do you have, if any, in terms of how Wachovia is going to be resolved and whether or not we're going to liquidate them and do the standard least cost resolution or invoke the systemic risk exception? Tell me about your involvement, and then I'll ask
follow-up
questions.
Yeah, I was involved all weekend, but my involvement was really just providing information and you know, making recommendations in terms of, you know, they would send us information from Wells or send us some information from Citibank, and they go, you know, this is Citibank's assumptions. Do you agree or disagree with them? Or, you know, here's a valuation. And really, when it got down to the end, where you have the Citibank bid, and the Wells actually did submit a bid, but it was even inferior to Citibank's at the time. And you know, Wells was just asking for more time, and they were told they didn't have more time. And, you know, I wasn't really part of that recommendation that it had to be resolved on the weekend. You'll have to talk to the controller on that one. But we did, you know, opine on, you know, the Citibank bid, in our view, really had it. There was really not too much of a chance that the fund would be hit by the, you know, because it was kind of one of these, if the losses burn through some amount, you know, $60 billion or something like that. And we said, you know, the way it's structured, they're probably not going to have losses that high. Where the Wells had a smaller subset of assets, but there was much greater chance that the fund would be hit. So, you know, at the time, if that, you know, you had a choice between two really bad choices, the Citibank bid looked to be better.
So was your involvement, other than looking at information from Citi and Wells and that information being their information related to their bids for acquiring Wachovia with assistance, right?
At the time, yeah.
Right, at that time.
I mean,
but
initially,
other than that, did you have involvement other than that?
Yeah, well, I mean, we were there all weekend. You know, there were, of course, a lot of discussions about how bad's Golden West, how bad's the rest of the portfolio. You know, Wells had, frankly, their concern was the corporate and investment bank, because Wells is not a big investment banking company. And so Golden West really wasn't their concern because they, as bad as it was, you know, they could get their arms around it pretty easily. But they needed more time, is what they said, for the other, you know. So my involvement was trying to provide information to, you know, back to our principals to say, you know, here's what we think as a core staff. And we were working hand-in-hand with the Federal Reserve and the FDIC. I mean, we were all in one room. So, you know, we were trying to, you know, compare and contrast. And if we had different opinions, we'd talk them out. But, yeah, I was pretty much there all weekend and then, you know, on the phones at night. But it was more, you know, there's one set of phones that is people like me, and then there's the principals over here. And so the principal will come over and talk to, you know, myself, my counterpart at the FDIC, the counterpart at the Fed, and then they go back and confer and make decisions. So
by principal, are you talking about?
I'm talking
OCC?
About John Dugan,
OCC
Sheila Bair.
Principals. The regulator principals.
The regulator principals, the people that actually made the decisions on the weekend. So Tim Geithner, you know, Sheila Bair, John Dugan.
So. Other than that type, thank you for that.
Yeah.
What I'm particularly interested in hearing about, if you were involved, were any of the discussions that you may have been involved in about, you know, whether or not it was necessary to invoke the systemic risk exception, and given what I've read, you know, what the discussions were about, look, there's all these uninsured creditors out there, and this is what the risks are if we do a least cost regular liquidation. Those folks are going to take hits. That's going to have an impact on the banking industry. That's going to have an impact on the general economy. Were you involved in any of those types of discussions?
Not really. Other than the fact that I knew the FDIC was preparing a liquidation case, that's about as much as I knew. I believe most of us on the ground believed that just was ridiculous because, I mean, we went into the weekend with Wells expecting to do an unassisted bid, and then they got, you know, cold feet and everything kind of, you know, fell apart from there. But, you know, I was involved, again, at the staff level in discussions of, you know, why can't you let Wachovia open the doors on Monday, you know. And obviously that decision was made a couple of grades above my pay grade as well. But, you know, Wachovia still had liquidity, and Wachovia, of course, still had capital. So, you know, but you think about what the market was like that weekend, you know, it had to be a market-based decision as much as it was an institution in particular type decision. Because there were concerns about if Wachovia opens on Monday, yeah, they'll be able to fund themselves, but for how long? And then number two, what will that do to the markets? And, you know, for example, you know, if Wachovia gets their debt ratings downgraded, you know, what's that going to do to the money market funds that hold Wachovia paper, and they break a buck, and, you know, this whole financial crisis that's rapidly escalating and has been for the whole month of September just, you know, takes that next step, and the next institution gets taken out. So, you know, I think that was, and again, I'm not going to put words in Doug Roeder's or John Dugan's mouth, but I think that's some of the discussions they had. But I wasn't really involved in that much, other than saying Wachovia could open the doors on Monday if that's what you decide. You know, you know.
Right. But other than, I mean, you mentioned that. You know, generally you were involved in those types of discussions, and the concerns were, yes, they can fund themselves, we don't know for how long, and if they can't fund themselves, what are going to be the implications, we're going to have another break the buck, et cetera, et cetera. But were there, other than those general types of discussions, what had a decision been made? Do you know that Kobe is not opening for business on Monday as a standalone company?
I guess prior to
the vote on Monday morning at 6:30 in the morning.
I think, and I'll let John Dugan answer that. I think that was the presumption, and the only reason I know that is because I know Wells said, just give us a few more days, and they were told, you know, you don't have a few more days. You need to make your best bid, you know, by Sunday night.
Do you know if anybody, if Wachovia management wanted to open Monday morning?
I think they, again, I wasn't part of those discussions. I think they did. I mean, going into the weekend, as I recall it, and my boss, Mike Brosnan, recalls it, they came to us and said, this is what we're going to do, you know, with WAMU. And it, as you know, what really triggered this was when they closed WAMU on Thursday and didn't protect the bondholders. Mm-hmm. And the whole world changed for Wachovia after that. And it really didn't even, it wasn't even apparent early on Friday morning. It was only as we moved into mid-morning that we started to see counterparties really just say, we don't want to do business with you anymore. And so it happened that quickly. But, you know, then on Friday afternoon, when they came back to all the regulators, not just the OCC, and said, you know, before they were going to do a capital raise, now they said, we're going to move to finding a strategic partner.
This but is Wachovia executives saying.
Wachovia executives.
And they're saying this when?
Friday afternoon, Friday night. And, I mean, from my recollection, you know, it was more, we're telling you we're going to do this. It wasn't asking for government assistance, not at that time. And things kind of deteriorated through the weekend. I think at least going into the weekend, they had no clue that they were going to have to be resolved
So let me ask you this, because as you anticipated, I was eventually going to get to September 25th in WAMU.
Yeah.
But first, was the Wells deal, the unassisted Wells deal, on the table before WAMU failed? Do you know?
I don't think so. But I don't know. You know, they may have talked to Wells, but I don't know how much.
Okay.
There must have been at least some conversation because, you know, on Saturday it sounds like Wells was ready to buy Wachovia, you know. And then again, like I said, they got cold feet because of the corporate and investment bank. And you know, what they were saying was not that we, you know, they say we still want to buy them, but we want to make sure that, you know, we know what we have, you know. and as regulators, that's what we want, right? You know, how can you argue with that, you know? So
just buy it.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that on Saturday you thought there was still a deal and that Wells got cold feet because of, I think you said, the corporate investment bank.
Yeah.
So what, do you, any more color on that, what their concerns were?
They just, Wachovia obviously was into a lot of investment banking, you know, structured products, you know, with a lot of counterparty exposure, which is another reason they'd be systemically important, but and, you know, when you look at these exposure reports and, you know, you have to sort of figure out all the netting and all that, and it just takes some time to see, you know, not to say there wasn't lots of problems, but, you know, what we were trying to say was the problems that are there are generally well identified and, you know, kind of what you see is what you get. And, you know, Wells said, well, we believe you, but, you know, we wanted to verify that ourselves, and I would have done the same thing if I were them. So.
Right. So you had mentioned that, you know, Washington Mutual gets taken over after close of business on Thursday the 25th, and, you know, the whole world changes, and that's what triggers the problems with Wachovia's counterparties. And you mentioned that on Friday morning, things at least started out somewhat okay.
Yeah.
But then later on, you said counterparties saying we don't want to do business with you. And you also just mentioned in terms of Wells that there were exposure reports. I mean, one of the areas, given this whole too big to fail focus that we have, you know, of course, we're interested in when and why counterparties decided to get out. So first of all, what do you recall? Well, I guess so my two questions are, what type of exposure reports were you guys looking at that showed who the counterparties were, what the types of business relationships were, and the amounts. And then two, give me some more color, if you can, on, you know, counterparties saying later on in the morning on Friday the 26th or whenever, look, we're not going to roll the repos, we're not going to roll the commercial paper or whatever, or we're going to withdraw our broker deposits or what if to the extent they're uninsured, or whatever.
Well, and I mean, obviously we were, you know, we had bank reports and we were also doing our own projections, you know, taking categories of exposures and when they mature and looking at the deposit runoff. And you know, they had very significant deposit runoff within their corporate investment bank, but that share of total deposits of Wachovia was very small. So, you know, they had a big runoff and a little piece of their business in terms of deposits. The general bank, which is really Wachovia's bread and butter, you know, with the branches and the middle market lending and all the retail lending, the deposit runoff wasn't that great. But the color on the counterparts is more just our people and the Federal Reserve sitting over there with them on, you know, with the traders and on the desks. And, you know, not only were counterparties saying we're not going to roll these things, we want our money back early, you know, especially like money market funds. And, you know, if they had commercial paper or something, they were worried about breaking the buck. And so there was just an awful lot of pressure to, you know, pay us out, if you will. And I think because of that pressure, you know, Wachovia was just concerned, as we were, you know, how long can we continue to fund? Well, you know, Friday night when they closed, they still had a $16 billion positive balance with the Fed. You know, they had, you know, $30 billion maybe of very marketable stuff they could sell. They had, you know, round numbers, $50, $60 billion of haircut collateral sitting at the discount window, which they hadn't used the discount window yet. So, I mean, there was still lots of liquidity there, but we ran some scenarios, and especially that weekend, I'm talking about our core staff in conjunction with the Federal Reserve, and depending on what the assumptions you use, you know, Wachovia could survive for many months, or in the most severe scenario, it was 7 business days, so just over a week, you know. You know, that's the inputs that we were providing to the decision makers that were trying to make the decision on, you know, do you let them open the doors? But I think there was a presumption that there needed to be resolved because, you know, you had the banks in Europe that were teetering, the money market fund stuff. I mean, there was just a lot of issues that they thought that even if Wachovia opens and they're fine as an individual institution, you know, what does that do to the markets? And of course, you know, you remember Bush, I mean, signed TARP that next Wednesday. So right. The timing was.
Right. So you mentioned that, you know, the traders on Wachovia's trading desk, you know, were sending the message of, hey, not only are counterparties saying we're not going to roll, but they want their money back, even though it's not due yet.
Right.
Did you have any of those conversations with any of the traders?
Most of those were with my capital markets lead, Mary Jane Reisinger. And really a lot of it was, you know, we had people within Wachovia that would report out to us, and they were talking to the traders, and then they would come back and say, yeah, we're under a lot of pressure. So that's generally how it happened. When I say they sat on the trade, I mean they were just over in that liquidity area, mm-hmm. and you know, they were monitoring the Wachovia officials that were monitoring the situation. Mm-hmm. So,
do you know who those officials were? You know, a guy by the name of Angus McBride.
That's who it was. Thank you. Angus McBride was our primary person that both the Federal Reserve and ourselves were talking to. Obviously,
at Wachovia.
Yeah, he was sort of the liquidity person that we spent a lot of time with on, not only, you know, during this weekend, but prior to, you know, in trying to determine how much, if any, strain Wachovia was under.
Right.
Thank you for the name.
I think he was the guy you're also talking to, sort of going back months on the whole contingency funding plan and all that kind of stuff. Right?
Yes.
Okay. So, and when Angus McBride is talking to the OCC folks, is he primarily talking to Mary Jane Reisinger?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And she was part of your examination team?
Yeah, she was my capital markets team lead. Okay. And there were people on Mary Jane's staff that were also involved. And, of course, the Federal Reserve had people as well. So.
Do you know if anybody, including yourself, mm-hmm. at the OCC actually talked to to Wachovia counterparties, as opposed to just getting the reports from McBride, who's talking to the trading desk?
No, we didn't.
Okay.
I can't speak for the Fed, but we didn't.
Before Friday the 26th, actually, let me write this down before I forget. Before Friday the 26th, were you hearing reports from Wachovia that counterparties were saying, we're not going to roll, we want our money back?
Not to any great extent, other than, you know, the type of language you saw in that report. I mean, because of the markets, there was a lot more caution going on.
But I'm sorry. Which report are you talking about?
The exhibit number one.
Oh, thank you.
What we were talking about,
right,
before on the liquidity comment.
Just so the record's clear, on page 12 of the report, 886 Bates range, there is a sentence that some large fund providers are already limiting Wachovia exposure. I believe that's what you were referring
to. Yes, yes. And that obviously continued and didn't get any better as, you know, we moved into the month of September and you had, you know, the Freddie and Fannie and the Lehman failure and the AIG and, you know, all the things that preceded it. But up until the WaMu event, even though we knew that these large institutions were under strain and we knew it's a possibility, I think we believed, the Federal Reserve believed, the bank believed, that something like what happened that last weekend in September was a remote possibility. You know, we still believed, even though there was strain there, that, you know, there was sufficient liquidity, sufficient contingency funding, you know, that sort of thing. And like I said, I mean, even on that Friday, there was still liquidity, but there's a huge concern about what might happen over the next few days. And so, It was very, very fast. I mean, it just the world totally changed at Wachovia. I mean, it already occurred at Lehman Brothers and Merrill Lynch and AIG and, you know, all that. But the Wachovia event really was precipitated primarily by WaMu and the fact that they said, well, WaMu has a bunch of mortgages in California and so does Wachovia because of Golden West. And, you know, that was some of the major concerns that we were told that the counterparties had, and this would again be through Angus McBride.
So WaMu had a lot of pay option arms in California.
They had a lot of pay option arms. Yeah, exactly. It just looked too much the same, and of course, I don't think the markets believed that the bondholders would have been stiffed at WaMu, and when that happened, then they totally looked at Wachovia very differently. So.
When Chris was talking about the report, he was referencing, I guess, Exhibit 1 about fund providers. I've seen in other institutions where funding was provided, but more at the base of the curve. So for CP, instead of going out 60 days, 70 days, you'd see 45, 30, 15. So it was more towards the base of the curves. Is that
That's very accurate. Yeah, and that's when Chris asked before, you know, shortening maturities, maybe limiting the amount. You know, maybe before they, you know, do 50 million, now it's 25, you know, something like that.
Lower the position limits and lower the tenor.
Yeah. But again, I don't think that was unique to Wachovia. I mean, I think counterparties were doing that with a lot of institutions, you know.
So, I mean, you know, one of the things that I am trying to not just me, but we are trying to understand, is sort of trying to differentiate between counterparties making decisions just sort of based on overall concern about market disruption in the banking industry in general and events that are sort of Wachovia firm specific, or mm-hmm. at least related to Wachovia. And clearly, you know, I throw the WAMU, you know, failure suddenly ratchets up the concern about Wachovia itself, as opposed to just sort of the banking industry in general. But did you see, remember back on July 22nd, 2008, is when, you know, Wachovia announces the big, like, $9 billion net loss, when, you know, loan loss provisions, goodwill write-offs, et cetera. And on that same day is the day that the Fed, you know, I don't know that this was public, but the Fed hits them with their letter report saying here's a bunch of requiring attention. And
we coordinated all
right.
That.
I mean, yeah. they're yeah. very similar,
right?
So, not surprisingly, and a couple weeks later, you know, your letter, the August 4th letter goes out. Did you see? I think you sort of answered this, but did you see counterparties, you know, changing their risk exposures to Wachovia after that announcement?
Some, but
the announcement, the July
22nd, yeah.
and that $9 billion net loss write-off is
consolidated right.
not
right.
the bank.
Correct.
I'd say there was some, but it wasn't. It wasn't significant compared to that, you know, the WAMU thing. I mean, mm-hmm. There's a little strain and. You know, there was a lot of talk, as you know, the pecking order of who's going to go next. You
right.
know, as soon as Lehman went, it's who can be next, you know, and Lehman and Merrill, you know, then is it going to be Morgan Stanley? Well, Wachovia somewhere was on that list, you know, and it was on the list before, like, a Chase. Nobody right. knew what Citibank, I mean, that's... So from that standpoint, I mean, you know, we had discussions, and that's why we obviously were ratcheting up the contingency funding. You know, yeah, what you did before was pretty good, but, you know, it's a different world now. You need to be really crisp and clear about, you know, how you're going to fund yourselves if your providers leave and, you know, that sort of thing. But we still, as I said, until that Thursday night, Friday morning, really thought it was a remote possibility. But I think I wasn't alone. There were other institutions that thought the same thing. So, I think the Wachovia specific versus the market really was those pay option arm, you know, mortgages, because as bad as they were in reality, the perception, I think, is what drove it more than anything, you know. So. And as you recall, that the perception of all banks was not very good.
Any discussion of revolving or any concerns about Citi acquiring Covia, given that Citi itself had some issues?
Are you asking me personally?
Well, I'm initially asking you whether there were discussions at the time, you know, that you were involved in or knew of about, you know, look, yeah, Wachovia is in trouble and we can't let them open on Monday and we got to find an acquirer. Citi? You know, versus Wells, and not just looking at the terms of their bids, but looking at the conditions of those companies.
No, there were comments about, is this like a huge First Republic where you put two problem institutions together and then the whole thing goes down? Really, again, my involvement was, you know, what's the best bid in terms of protecting the fund at that time? You know, meaning, you know, if Citi buys them and Citi survives, you know, this loss share agreement or what it was, you know, if they eat through whatever it was, $60 billion of losses, then, you know, the FDIC fund picks up part of it. You know, we thought that that was a remote possibility, and that's really what we focused on. In terms of the condition of Citi versus the condition of Wachovia, and does that make sense to put the two together? Again, that was Doug Broder, John Dugan, and our agency, and, you know, that level at the agencies. I can tell you personally, I was glad to see Wells come back in because, you know, I just thought it was a much, much better fit. It is, as to your point, Chris. You knew a Wachovia Wells is going to survive. You wonder about a Citi Wachovia, you know, so... and news are relevant.
In a city without Wachovia.
Yes.
The jury's still out.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so what can you tell me, if anything, about, I mean, I've read some of the stuff about why Wells comes back with an unassisted bid.
I think they did what they wanted. They had a little more time to figure out what they had in the investment bank, and they said maybe it's not that bad, and they came back in. But again, I wasn't involved in any of that. I mean, you know, the Wells coming back in was just as big a surprise to me as it was to everybody else when it came out public, you know.
I've heard reference, and I don't know if this is true, but they got a tax opinion that indicated they were going to be able to use tax loss carry forwards that essentially made them able to make an unassisted bid. Is that?
I think that figured into it, but again, I only know that from what I read in the press, you know. So, but obviously that was a big decision maker as well.
But you don't have any independent knowledge.
I don't have any independent knowledge of that. Doug probably does, since he, you know, both Wachovia and Wells.
I'm going to tell him when I interview him that you know, well, Dave Wilson said that you'd be able to answer all these questions.
I already told him I was going to throw, when it gets to his level or the controller's level, it's not.
Okay. Very close. I take it you did not attend the FDIC board meeting on the morning of the 29th, whether in person or by phone?
No, not at all. That's a John Dugan question.
any discussions with Mr. Dugan or any other folks that did attend the meeting after the fact?
After the fact? Mm-hmm. I did not have any discussions with John Dugan.
Or anyone else?
Yeah. You know, obviously, my direct boss, Mike Brosnan at the time, who, you know, reports to Doug, you know, he just basically said what happened, but, you know, it was more just, you know, what's known in the press. You know, he was in Charlotte with us during the weekend, and, you know, we focused just on having a meeting of our staffs and trying to explain to him what happened, even though we were still sort of shell-shocked on what happened as well. So we were sort of focused from that standpoint.
Were you having any dealings with the folks at the New York Fed during this weekend? This weekend being the weekend of the 27th and 28th.
You know, well, I'm sorry. Yeah. He said that they were all working together to provide information.
But
the
this
staff.
this was the Richmond Fed, though.
Right.
To be fair, because that was the core staff. We didn't have any direct dealings with like the Geithner and the New York Fed. Mm-hmm. But you know, as I said, we were providing information. You know, the Richmond Fed ourselves, the FDIC, our local dedicated examiner Robert Burns, and we were providing, you know, information to our respective agencies, which obviously for the Fed included the New York Fed, but I was not on calls with the New York Fed. Thank you.
I've seen in some of the memos that there were $183 billion of uninsured deposits at Wachovia, which to me seems awfully high. Does that sound right?
What memos are you referring to?
It was either the Richmond Fed memo or an FDIC memo. Actually, I shouldn't even guess. I should have it right here in my footnote.
Yeah. I know the FDIC did work on that.
It's a memo by the Richmond Fed.
Is that on a consolidated basis or the bank?
It's I don't know from my writing, but I suspect on a consolidated basis.
It's probably consolidated, but to be fair, it was probably primarily bank. That seems high to me, too. And I'm not sure that I ever really discussed. I do recall a discussion I had with Robert Burns at the FDIC, and I believe that they were saying, well, they were trying to be conservative with the number because, for example, you know, accounts that were over 100,000 at the time, there may be like two people in the account, and so it's really 200,000, not 100,000, and they didn't have time to figure all that out. And I believe that's it. So the number probably is high. You know, they probably did a conservative number, but yeah, it does seem very high because, like I say, deposits in the corporate investment bank weren't that huge, so you'd have to look at the general bank, and that's generally, I mean, there's a lot of middle market deposits that are probably above 100,000, but a lot of it is just bread and butter, small business consumers, things like that, and I wouldn't expect it to be that much. So,
do you recall anybody within the OCC or anybody that you were talking to or heard from that was against invoking the systemic risk exception and wanted to just do the usual least cost resolution liquidation?
Well, I don't think anybody was in favor of the liquidation. I mean, in reality, I know they prepared the case, but again, you'll have to ask my superiors on that, but I don't think anybody thought that was a good idea. I think, you know, we all believe Wachovia had franchise value, and they were just caught up in the liquidity crunch of the time, and that, you know, getting them to the other side would be the least cost resolution, not just liquidating them.
And when you were saying we all thought that, were you just talking OCC? Or were you talking Fed?
I was just
FDIC.
Well, I was talking at the staff level. I guess it was, would, you know, among our conversations. I don't know what was being said at the principal level.
Okay, but staff. Yeah, with the, right.
Staff.
When you're talking
like
staff.
Our core staff.
Of, you know, the OCC.
Well, you know, I think the Fed and the,
right,
the FDIC at the staff level believe that as well. But
so those were conversations among the staff of those three regulators during the weekend?
Yeah.
Okay.
But, I mean, again, that was just us talking. I mean, that wasn't decision making.
One of the reasons I ask is because we've seen in the documents, including the minutes of the September 29, 2008 meeting of the FDIC board, where they approve it, where during that meeting, you know, Chairman Baer, so I don't misquote it.
Okay.
You know, make statements that that she doesn't know if it's the right decision, that she is not completely comfortable with it, and that she's acquiescing in the decision because, one, the Treasury's already voted, you know, to recommend that the systemic risk exception be done. You know, the Federal Reserve Board has already voted on it. Her colleagues, you know, the FDIC staff is recommending it. And, of course, the members of the FDIC board include Mr. Dugan of the OCC, Mr. Rich of the OTS, and they're all for it. But it's very evident, at least in reading the transcript, obviously I wasn't at the meeting, that she appears to be struggling with it, and rightfully so, right? I mean, you're invoking it for the very first time. But that's why I asked that question. I hear you, if that jogs memory bells. I get amongst the staff of you guys, you're all saying franchise value, we can't let this company go down. But did you hear anything or have any discussions with folks like, you know, well, these folks at Treasury, these folks at the FDIC, these folks at the New York Fed, these folks at the Richmond Fed, whatever it is, you know, don't want to do it, or, you know, think we should just do the usual least cost resolution.
Yeah, I you know, I, that doesn't surprise me about Sheila Bair, but I don't think that was the generally held view of most of us. You know, I think there was franchise value. But again, you know, that's really a John Dugan question.
Just for clarification, you said that she was uncomfortable with it and voted for it because who had already voted for it? The New York Fed or the Fed or the...
According to the minutes. The transcript of the meeting, and I will say, here's the quote. Well, I think this is one option of a lot of not a very good options. I would note for the record that both the Treasury and the Federal Reserve Board weighed in early on for us to provide a systemic risk exception. In fact, the Federal Reserve Board several hours ago voted on a systemic risk exception before we even acted. So they clearly both pressed for this, and I know it was important to the OCC as well. She continues, I have acquiesced in that decision. I'm not completely comfortable with it. So it is what it is. There would be some ellipses was in there. Those weren't continuous statements. But generally, you know, she's, the way I read it anyway, uncomfortable. Other people want it and is acquiescing in that decision. That was the basis for my question to see if that jogged any memory bells. Al, do you have any questions?
Just one follow-up.
Sure.
On Friday afternoon, when you noticed that funds providers were starting to hold back, was there an event during that day that triggered an acceleration of that, or was that just took a few hours to set in and then people started just...
I think it was more of that. There wasn't any single event. I think it was just absorbing what happened the night before. And, you know, I don't know how all these things in the marketplace get going, but, you know, all these traders and counterparties and everything, they talk to each other. And, you know, from what you hear, I mean, I think basically what was in the press was true, that, you know, there was sort of a run on the bank in a sense, and in the sense that everybody started saying, well, Wachovia is in trouble. They look like Washington Mutual. You know, if they're going to stiff the bondholders for Washington Mutual, why wouldn't they do the same thing for Wachovia? You know, obviously Wachovia had put themselves in the harm's way with some strategic decisions, and you just have to remember what the environment was. This was the week before they passed TARP. It was a couple of weeks before they actually made the investments into the banks. So the timing was the very worst. You know, we were hoping that Wachovia was the last person to get shot in Vietnam, but, you know, that's not, I guess you had Nat City after that, and hopefully that's the last one of the big, obviously the small ones, there's a lot, but that's more of a, as bank examiners, we can understand a traditional credit, a failure where, you know, you just burn through your capital and, you know, you have to be resolved. These systemic, you know, liquidity, market fear-driven resolutions are more difficult.
Yeah, the credit-sensitive wholesale providers of funds are very hard to plan for.
Yeah.
Anything else? Mr. Wilson, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it very much.
I will tell you
what I tell everybody at the end that Linda's probably getting tired of hearing of. We will, of course, talk amongst ourselves, look at our notes. If we realize we forgot to ask you something, I'll contact Linda and just try to do it via a quick phone call. I'm not going to ask you for another in-person interview. So thank you very much for your time. I very much appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
So we're back here.